This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I am terrific.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies is the age of the BIPOC buster. It's a portmanteau of the phrase BIPOC, meaning Black, Indigenous, and people of color, and blockbuster, of course, meaning big hit movie, coming to a close. That's one of the questions asked by Kabir Chibber in a New York Times op-ed headlined, "Is the awkward diversity era of Hollywood behind us?" In this piece, he highlights the weird ways in which minorities and women were kind of crammed into blockbusters, like, for instance, the 2016 female-led gender-swapped Ghostbusters, or, you know, kind of the more recent wave of Marvel projects, like the sequel to Captain Marvel, Shang-Chi, some other stuff. Here he is, quote, "Hollywood has its eras, often apparently only in retrospect. Think back several years. Do you remember packed theaters giving Black Power salutes at screenings for Black Panther? Do you remember when an all-female version of Ghostbusters was treated as a pioneering development? Do you remember when the writer of a Star Wars film described the Empire as a white supremacist human organization after Donald Trump's 2016 election? Has enough time now passed to say that was all a bit strange?" End quote. One of the questions he posits is whether or not we'll look back at something like Barbie's invocation of the patriarchy as the film's bad guy, so to speak, you know, at least in so far as a concept can be a bad guy, and be able to use that to kind of instantly place it within our cultural moment, right? The same way that we can place Rambo and his greasy hair and bandoliers, or Arnold and his biceps and glasses, pretty firmly in the 1980s. I think it's certainly possible. Every era has their heroes and their villains, and the combination of endless intellectual property exploitation combined with a rushed desire to create more roles for women and minorities led to some super weird stuff that felt at the time like pandering and only really got a pass because some of the most annoying people on the internet were vocally mad about it. It is funny. It is funny because somebody asked me the other day, well, why is it that Moana and its sequel never really became culture war punching bags? You know, why weren't people screaming about, oh, the woke Polynesian princess, you know? And I think the answer is honestly fairly obvious, which is that Moana was an original creation that felt authentic within her own kind of skin and, you know, felt authentic as a cultural creation. And they weren't shoehorning her into some other series. They weren't, you know, they weren't like doing a weird race flip thing.
Also, it was good, right?
Also, it was good.
Moana is like solidly entertaining children's movie. Like, it's fun for the family. Lin-Manuel Miranda writes those animated movie bangers. They're good. Like, if you have not, you know, like, done a full family car sing-along of You're Welcome, like, I feel sorry for you because it's great. But look, a lot of the sort of, you know, diversity engineered stuff, like, yes, I mean, you know, people were annoyed over Lady Ghostbusters and it was stupid, but was anyone like super enthusiastic about Lady Ghostbusters in like an authentic, serious way, right? Like, this stuff is bad, not because it's diverse, but because it's pandering and condescending in the name of diversity. It's rooted in a misunderstanding of what those audiences actually want. And so something like Shonda Rhimes' sort of riff on Julia Quinn's Bridgerton novels is wildly popular because it is, you know, a sort of a reimagining of an existing property in a way that has some actual sort of heft and intrigue involved in it. But it's like, it's what ladies want, right? It's like sex and romance and fizzy gossip and like fun stuff. It is, you know, I'm sorry, like I, you know, the return of the romantic comedy and like the sort of rise of the ironic, you know, sort of Hallmark movie and Hallmark-esque, you know, holiday movie industry is like, is much more about what listening to the presumed target audience actually wants than like Lady Ghostbusters. Sorry, rant over.
No, it's fine that you interrupted my introduction, Alyssa. That's okay. You know, I know that I can go on for a bit. We got people in the audience cheering right now, I'm sure. Shut them up. shut him up. He goes on too much. But here's the other thing, right? Peter, you sent us the post that the Entertainment Strategy guy put out a couple days ago. He was highlighting a study that showed that there is greater on-screen representation of Black, Hispanic, and Asian actors, right? When you look at the year's most successful and most prestigious cinematic releases. And it was an interesting study, too, because it was based on the percentage of screen time rather than, like, well, what kind of roles are they? And, you know, it used some kind of interesting AI technology to break that down and check
AI
it all out.
Because AI is good.
No, it's bad. It's bad. Everybody listen to Bulwark Goes to Hollywood this week to hear how bad it is. But here's the broad question that New York Times piece posits, right? Which is, like, is this era over? Is this era of, like, kind of blockbuster diversity over? And I have to say I'm skeptical. I'm skeptical, right? Just because if you look at these sorts of movies that are being made, 19 of the 20 biggest films of the year are sequels, and Wicked is not exactly, like, not a sequel, right? It's technically not a sequel or a prequel. It's its own kind of weird reimagining thing, but, like, come on, you know, let's be real here. As long as the twin demands of IP-based blockbusters and increased diversity exist at the same time, we're still going to see this sort of thing, and I don't think we're going to see much less of it, right, Peter? Or can we say, like, well, these other things are successful, maybe we don't have to go back to this?
I think this is an interesting question, and Alyssa, you have an answer to this before I...
Yeah, Alyssa, you really want to jump in again. Alyssa, go for it.
Well, I was going to say, I think that what we may see a return to is something that looks a lot more like Twisters, right? Which is, you know, that's a movie that has, you know, a man, a woman, a man of color in the sort of, you know, lead triangle, and that actually in a lot of ways looks like an era of kind of late 90s, early aughts blockbusters that was, you know, diverse in the sense that you had, like, Will Smith leading Independence Day, or, you know, you had, again, like, a bunch of women in sort of prominent summer blockbuster roles in things like Twister, or Jurassic Park, et cetera. And so a return to the sort of ensemble blockbuster that looks a lot more like America without being sort of self-consciously diverse, I think would be both, like, would make sense from a sort of movie making standpoint and from a, you know, just sort of treating the audience in a non-condescending, unself-conscious way that would make a lot more sense.
No, I think you're basically right here. I do wonder, like, where this is going to go, because it really seems like there is, since the election in particular, there is an explicit understanding, sometimes being forced from people who are critics of a kind of DEI, woke culture, whatever we're going to call it. I don't know of a neutral term that we can use here. Sometimes from people who sort of were on the other side, who were like, well, I thought this was pretty good at the time, but it seems like maybe it went too far. That a lot of that stuff, there just seems to be like a growing a consensus is definitely not right, but recognition by a lot of folks that, like, some of that went too far, especially during the pandemic year 2020. What does that mean then in practice? Like, how do tastemakers and culture makers respond to that? For one thing, I think they haven't had time to respond, and so we don't know what they're going to do. For another thing, the next year's worth of Hollywood productions are already in production. So whatever it is that's going to change because people think, well, we need to change something, it's not going to change, at least in terms of theatrical releases or scripted television shows, all of which tend to finish shooting. I mean, it's almost always at least 6 months and frequently more like 18 months from the final day of shooting to the when these things get released, whether it's TV or movies, right? So we will start to see change. If there are changes, we are going to see them on a lag, much more likely, say, early 2026 rather than, next month or already. Right. And I think we will probably just see more of what we were seeing, though, like even before the election and even before people thought, oh, maybe we need to take a different tack to some of this stuff. And what we were seeing beforehand is a lot more basic old style television. And so some of that is Some of that is what Alyssa was talking about, you know, the return of rom-coms on Hallmark. And like part of what the Hallmark approach to rom-coms is to be basic, is to be unapologetic about this is not high art. It's enjoyably trashy. But you see that in dude shows too, as well, like Reacher in particular. But then a lot of the shows that are sort of that are like following the Reacher model of like, this is dad TV. It's just action. And like, that's what we're going to get. And that stuff is tends to be coded as less, I don't know, politically left, woke, diversities, whatever. At the same time, a lot of those shows also tend to have notable roles for people of color, for women, for right. Like, and there's been a movement to sort of to change up the sort of the way those shows look and who gets cast in those shows, even if the central characters are often, oh, it's the same folks who we've been seeing before. But then the other thing is, if you look at, this is the first year, I think, ever, where all of the top 10 films in at the box office in North America are sequels. And that means, I think, that we are going to see just a digging in on IP from Hollywood. Hollywood is just going to kind of do the IP thing. We're just going to get sequel, after reboot, after remake. That is what we are going to get more than ever. And part of managing an intellectual property is expanding who that IP talks to, but also figuring out ways to reproduce basically the same thing, but a little bit different. And so if you are making Spider-Man, if you are making, I don't know, Star Trek, Ghostbusters, whatever it is, it's just always going to be on the table, like sort of up for, what do we want to do with this property? If we want to make it a little the same, but a little bit different, oh, well, if this had a white cis man in the lead, maybe we don't want that the next time. Maybe we'll try a different version of that. And I think we will see, in just because of the way that like sequel management and IP management works, where you have to do the same thing, but talk to a different group of people and make it feel just a little bit fresh in some way. I think we will see some of that, but like, I think we will see. Yeah. So I'm trying to figure out what I don't know that I have like a macro point here, except we don't know how people are going to react to the vibe shift. We won't see scripted versions of this. We won't see that reaction in scripted shows or movies for a year or two. And go through IP over the history of comic books, science fiction, genre shows in particular. Most of these genres develop to a point where fandom becomes not just a bunch of nerdy white dudes, and there is a movement to showcase other types of characters, whether that's in Star Trek in the 1960s, whether that is in Jack Kirby talking about Asian and Black superheroes in comic books in the 1970s, whether that's the last 10 years of Lady Ghostbusters and that sort of thing. Like, this is not just a brand new thing that we've only seen, you know, since 2013 or whatever. And I think that type of that way to approach and manage IP is going to continue to exist and flourish, especially as IP takes over the big moneyed Hollywood properties.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that's interesting from this New York Times op-ed, I'll make sure to link to it in the email so people can read it. But one of the things that's interesting about it is the way it kind of couches these as wins in name only, right? So like the real issue isn't so much like, well, you know, it's good that we, or it's bad that we had more diverse actors in Marvel movies. It's that pretending that anything to do with an MCU movie of this sort is like a big cultural win. That's what's aggravating, right? So like, for instance, let me just expand this a little bit. You know, before the movie that we are talking about today, I saw a trailer for Ryan Coogler's upcoming film, Sinners, right? And this is a movie that is set in the American South in the, you know, first half of the 20th century. And it has it is all about a Black town. And, you know, it's like kind of a ghost or a vampire story or something. It's really interesting trailer, really good, but it's new original product. Like, this being a thing that is made and created and getting a wide release on 3,000 screens is a win in a way that something like you know, having black sidekick in a Captain America movie is not a win. Like, that is, like, that is an actual cultural, an interesting cultural creation that's not just window dressing designed to make, to take heat off the studio that is making these movies.
And also, you know, frankly, like, a welcome return to form for Coogler, who I sort of worried was going to get stuck doing IP or you know, sort of sequels or reinventions forever. Unless I really liked Creed, but, you know, he hasn't made an original movie in a while. Fruitvale Station was great. And so I am, you know, to if the era of sort of obsessively self-conscious but not very artfully executed diversity ends in, like, the MCU or sort of in franchise world, and we actually get to a place where some of these directors who came up from small indie projects to do these big blockbusters, if those folks then get to make their next original movies and they're good and interesting, that could potentially be a really interesting development for actual lovers of cinema.
I think that the era of things like Frances McDormand going on stage at the Oscars and saying inclusion writers, like, and making that like the thing that she is going to use her 30 seconds of national airtime to promote, I suspect that that is over. And that impulse will be maybe not gone, but will be, we will see it much less in the next 3 or 4 years.
Well, maybe. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. All right. So what do we think? Is the state of diversity in media a controversy or a non-controversy? I don't really know how to summarize this idea in a pithy way, but, like, what do we think? Is this era, you know, over, not over? What's going to happen? Alyssa?
I don't entirely know. I sort of find it a controversy because, despite someone who cares about sort of representation and, you know, sort of variety in media, I don't think this era of stuff was necessarily that successful at achieving what those of us who cared about it wanted. And so if we're on to the next thing, I'm good with that.
Peter?
I think this era is over, and this era is over in two ways. One is the obsession with diversity for its own sake, often at the expense of the underlying film product. But then also it's over because Hollywood is going to cease to matter all that much. It's already happening. And it's just going to be YouTube and AI. And YouTube and AI will have different things that they prioritize, some of which will be dumb.
It's interesting. I think it's kind of a controversy, but the thing that was most interesting about this whole story to me is the venue in which this op-ed it was published. I do not see the New York Times publishing a piece like this a year ago or 2 years ago or even 6 months ago. There has been a vibe shift. The vibe shift has happened. The vibes are different, which is in and of itself kind of interesting. All right. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus for our bonus episode on Friday. We're going to be talking about the Golden Globes nominees out this week. Emilia Perez, 10 nominations. Can you believe it? We'll talk about all sorts of stuff. But now on to the main event. Night Bitch. I feel awkward saying that out loud. Am I allowed to say Night Bitch? It's the title of the movie.
I will grant you dispensation to say Night Bitch out loud.
Okay, I feel, I mean, I can type it, you know, but saying it feels weird. But then, you know, the lead character of the film, who is known only as Mother and played by Amy Adams, calls herself that. So I think I'm okay. I think it's okay. I think we can do that. I think it's all right. Anyway, she doesn't have a name because this is one of those movies that really leans into the metaphor, right? Mother is just known as Mother because that's her only identity. Her husband, played by Scoot McNairy, is credited as Father because his failings are all in that realm. The baby that they have together is called, you guessed it, Baby, which leads to a very odd sequence about two-thirds of the way through the film where Mother is yelling baby in a crowded park to try and find the child. Mother spends all of her time with baby. Once an artist, she has decided to become a stay-at-home mom to really enjoy all those moments together. Of course, she does not enjoy the moments together. She feels stifled and unfulfilled. She is also exhausted, though I think we have to acknowledge it that this is at least partly her fault. She let baby sleep in the parental bed, and now he won't sleep in his own bed, so she doesn't get to sleep. And so she's tired all the time. This is a movie about how sleep deprivation drives you crazy, at least on one very basic level. Of course, we can't criticize her for this. We can't criticize Mother for doing this. And that's one of the problems with the movie. The lead character makes a series of either baffling or outright stupid decisions, and then tries to turn any criticism of those choices into just another aspect of how she is being stifled by the patriarchy and society at large, and what is everything that's gone wrong is, you know, part of the plot to keep her down. Look, as a key part of the patriarchy, as patriarch number one, I have to say that I don't buy that for a second. I'm sorry, she goes to a dinner with her art world friends and she orders a kale salad for no discernible reason. She hates kale. She's been craving meat the whole movie. Her compatriots are eating lamb. They're eating other meats at the table, which she wants because, you know, she's a dog, right? And then she freaks out. She freaks out at the dinner table, and we're all supposed to be like, oh, I can empathize with her being oppressed this way. Come on. Come on. Of course, I did just kind of gloss over the fact that, yes, she is turning into a dog at night, right? She runs with other dogs who may or may not be other moms in the neighborhood. It's a metaphor, you see. It's a metaphor for reconnecting with the primal magic of motherhood, et cetera, et cetera. Or maybe it's not a metaphor. Maybe it's actually happening. Who can say? Who can say? I don't know. I think Peter mentioned this in his review, but this is the sort of movie that makes me appreciate a similar movie, a movie that is thematically similar much more than I did the first time I saw it. The movie in question that he mentioned was The Substance, and that is very much how I feel about this. Both Night Bitch and The Substance make the subtext text. But The Substance has the decency to do it with this sort of gonzo style and over-eager enthusiasm. Despite The Substance being 40 minutes longer, Night Bitch felt like it was twice as long as The Substance. It's a slog because it's absolutely boring visually and orally. There's nothing visually interesting about this movie. Writer-director Marielle Heller's button-down style works much better for button-down subjects like Fred the Mr. Rogers movie, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, or even the kind of grounded, realistic scam of Can You Ever Forgive Me, right? Like, those movies, I think, are much better suited for what she is doing on screen. For a movie that is at least partly about the importance and power of art, and again, this is like kind of a running subplot of the film. She feels that she, you know, she has lost herself because she can't be the artist she was before having her child. Night Bitch is weirdly uninterested in how the artistry of film is used to visually convey information. The thing feels like a novel. It's a movie that feels like a novel. Like, it just, like, somebody is reading a novel on the screen, and we have some pictures of Amy Adams to accompany it. I don't know, Alyssa, I didn't like this, but I also feel like societal expectations demand that I at least feign appreciating it. Is there a way to make a movie about that sensation? That is, could I be transformed into like a Birdman or something? That would be.
So I am going to give you permission not to like this movie because I found myself pretty frustrated by it too.
Okay, good.
And I think there are a couple of reasons it did not land with me. The first is sort of the way the movie stacks the odds in a way that both makes Amy Adams' mother sort of more justified in losing her mind, but makes her losing her mind a much less interesting phenomenon to watch, right? I mean, the first is, so I'm going to confess something here, like, I find Scoot McNairy, like, really off-putting on screen, and I think that he's sort of leaned into, I mean, that's probably the result of, you know, a lot of the roles that he's played over time. But his character is also just sort of positioned as, like, kind of an awful husband and father. Like, he's given this job where he's, like, away all of the time. We only ever see him just, like, kind of be a pain in the ass and not that useful. Like, he's not good with his kid. That is literally text of the movie. He's not there, and he's, like, not willing to sort of step up. We don't know what he does for a living, so it's, like,
yeah, he writes reports on Thursday nights.
Yes, he writes reports. So he does some, like, white collar, like, I mean, it's not like he's, like, in the mines and is physically tired. Like, he's not a long distance trucker. But so the movie makes him sort of as off-putting and as sort of incompetent as possible. And as a movie about sort of maternal rage and the question of like whether being with a child is boring, it's a much less spiky movie if it sets up the situation as sort of legitimately unfair and grating, right? I mean, if this is going to be a movie about someone who potentially just hates motherhood, doing that in a situation where, like, actually the child care is more equitably divided, or, you know, the kid is less completely, like, this movie on some level wants to be, we need to talk about Kevin without the sort of serial murder, but without the spree murder, I should be clear. But it ends up feeling, it feels sort of anemic, right, to continue the sort of red meat craving metaphor, because it's not tapping into sort of a deeper well of resentment and rage. It ends up being about a sort of quotidianly annoying situation. And it's especially sort of disappointing because the novel that inspired Rachel Yoder to write the novel on which this is based, Department of Speculation, is sort of so much better. Yoder was inspired by the specific line where the narrator of Department of Speculation, which is great. If you haven't read it, you'll, like, even not reading at my speed, you'd knock it off in like an afternoon. It's short and fragmentary, but the main character says that, like, she never planned to be a wife or a mother. She was going to be an art monster instead. And that movie is just sort of much more funny and observational about, about parenting, even like with a good partner and with someone who is an involved, fantastic father, and the sort of ambiguities and sacrifices in even a situation that's like much fairer and much more normal and easier. And that narrator is just much more interesting, even without the possibility that she's either having a mental health crisis or turning into a dog. The writing in it is extremely interesting and fun as well. I cannot recommend Department of Speculation highly enough. But yeah, this felt histrionic in a way that wasn't actually that interesting to me. And I say this as someone who is pretty sympathetic to the idea that it's good. It was like, I tend to think, for me in particular, it was important to me to continue working while being a mom. My mother was really upfront with me when I had kids that, like, you know, she felt like her years as a stay-at-home mom were not the years when she was sort of most intellectually engaged or happy. She loved us. She was a fantastic mother. But she's also really, really good, for example, at figuring out how you renovate colonial-era buildings in the Boston area. And, you know, I think for me, you know, I adore my children. They are freaking great. But my sanity really depends on using that, you know, the sort of full intellectual capacity of my brain. And so I'm very sympathetic to the idea that, like, being a stay-at-home mom can drive you bananas, even as I also know that it is the right choice for, you know, a bunch of women of my acquaintance. But this movie is just sort of the least sympathetic version of that case. It's really skewed. And I'm frustrated because I feel like I haven't really liked an Amy Adams movie in quite some time. And I used to really like Amy Adams as an actress. And I don't know. I want my Amy Adams back.
She's good in this to the extent that she can be good in this,
yeah.
Which is, not a knock on her, but the material is just so weak. It's so, as you say, you know, the deck is stacked in her favor, but also, like, I have trouble sympathizing with a character who says one thing and then when everybody agrees with her gets mad that everybody agreed with her when she said and did a thing. And I just, like, this movie does this several times where she will say one thing and be like, no, you should have known I meant another thing. And, like, I'm sorry, that, you know, that is not a sympathetic state of being. Peter, in our text, you mentioned that you watched The Substance right after, a couple days after seeing Night Bitch, which is interesting. I like that movie a lot. I don't think it's necessarily a great. I don't know that it would be great for our show, Alyssa. I don't think you would love it. But the just the lots of violence, lots of stabbing.
I would love
and,
to
you
hear
know,
Alyssa's take on yeah. that movie.
It would be very interesting, but I think she would not enjoy the watching of it. Peter, what did you make of Night Bitch in comparison, you know, on its own, but also in comparison to some of these other movies?
I think this movie has a number of problems, several of which Alyssa astutely outlined. But the one that I want to focus on actually is the central metaphor itself. This is a story about a woman who is a mother who has mostly been left to her own devices by her husband, who is mostly out of the picture. And in the process, she becomes a dog. She becomes kind of feral, kind of animalistic, but also tamed, suburban, right? Like it is a potentially potent metaphor. And then the movie does nothing with the metaphor. And it's such a bizarre choice to make a provocatively titled body horror film in which the body horror aspect goes nowhere and does no narrative work, creates no real conflict for the character or what she wants or for anybody else in the film, with a maybe exception of one little scene in which she and the other dog she is running with kill the household cat. Except that even doesn't, that barely impacts the actual story, right? Even that is sort of, well, the cat's dead. That's, let's keep the kid away, right? Like there's, and this is the problem with this film is it wants to be a story about how becoming a mom and having to deal with all this brings out something animalistic in you. And then what? And it never answers the and then question. It never goes anywhere with any of this. Now, you think about the best body horror film. So probably the one that listeners are most familiar with would be The Fly, the 1980s Cronenberg film with Jeff Goldblum. And The Fly is one of the great body horror movies. And what it does is it directly connects the character's desires, his personality, the tension and the narrative conflict in that film is clearly integrated with his dark and sad transformation into Brundlefly. It's not just a little metaphor that's running alongside a story about a scientist who goes kind of crazy and has some maybe his ideas are a little bit dangerous. It is the story of. And this movie doesn't want to commit to its central metaphor. So it just runs it along almost along parallel, almost as if it is a dream sequence, almost as if it is the chorus, you know, the Greek chorus in an old play, right? Like it's commentary, but it doesn't have anything to do with the story, which is incredibly thin on its own. And so if you compare this to the Substance, which is the movie that you mentioned, Sonny, that movie takes its central metaphor and turns it into the main conflict and the main story, because it's a film about an aging Hollywood starlet actress who gets access to a substance that allows her to become young and beautiful every other week, except that if the young and beautiful version of her overstays her welcome, say takes an extra few hours or an extra day, well, when she transforms back into the older version of herself, she's not just older, she is withered and becoming, and she becomes somewhat and then eventually much, much, much more monstrous as the, right? And so it's about the temptation of youth and about the lure of it, especially in Hollywood, and about the way that men and older, middle-aged, executives in Hollywood abuse female talent and female bodies. And it takes that gross-out metaphor and it turns it into the story. Like the two are the same. And here you have a metaphor that's just like, well, it's like being a mom's like being a dog. And what? Like, okay, I'm actually interested by that. But then tell a story about a mom who becomes a dog. It is bizarre that we have there's a bit in which Amy Adams is in the bathroom and she lifts up her shirt and she's got dog nipples. And that's that. Well, we never come back to the dog nipples again.
Yeah. No, and I think part of what is weird about the movie's treatment of this is that part of what I have found really fun about being a mother is that sort of ascendant animalness and permission to play, right? Like some of the most fun sequences in the movie are when like Adams and her son are just like pretending to be dogs all day. When she gets him like sleeping in a dog bed and they're running around. And I will confess, like my 3-year-old son and I spent a certain amount of time pretending to be dogs. This was not inspired by Night Bitch. Like he just like one day declared that he was a puppy doggy and that I was mama doggy. And that's a thing now. And he does not sleep in a dog bed. He sleeps in his own bed and always has because.
Wait. But if he's a dog, doesn't
that dog bed look very comfortable?
It did look very comfortable. I mean, he sleeps basically like in a nest of stuffed animals. But in an actual human bed. I think Peter, you're totally right that the movie should have just embraced the metaphor more because part of what's really fun about getting to be a parent is the permission to just like behave in ways that are kind of strange, right? To like, you know, be odd, to play, to be like, you know what? Yes, like you guys are running a pirate ship and I have been commandeered, but also you're going to try and like sell me a bunch of buried treasure. And like, that's just what we're going to do this weekend. Or to just like be like puppy doggy and mama doggy. And the sort of the liberation from that sort of animalness is something that the movie doesn't sort of manage to quite embrace, right? Like, I mean, okay, Amy Adams like goes for a jog again and like she and Scoot McNairy eventually have sex again. But it doesn't embrace the sort of, you know, the sort of glee of being able to throw off inhibition that I think can be one of the great parts of becoming a parent. Like setting aside, like it's real weird to be kind of put back into, to like become an animal again after having been civilized for a lot of your life. But it can also just be really fun and really liberating to go back and question why some of the rules are the way they are. And the movie can't quite commit to either the body horror or the delight of becoming an animal. And it's a lot more boring as a result and sort of intellectually muddled.
Yeah.
There's a better movie lurking here in this concept that doesn't end with Amy Adams' character putting on an art show and finding herself, but instead ends with her and her dog pack, like saving the kids from, I don't know, something from some other predator, befriending the kids because the kids finally sort of learn to appreciate their dog mom and mom dog mom, right? Like this is the screenplay structure is like often described as thesis, antithesis, synthesis. And there's kind of fundamentally no synthesis here. It just doesn't get anywhere with its big idea.
Yeah. No, I think that's right.
All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Night Bitch? Alyssa.
Thumbs down.
Peter.
Amy Adams is good, but this is not a good movie. Thumbs down.
Thumbs down. It's very, very frustrating. Again, the hours crawled by as I was in the movie theater watching.
And
this is not a long movie. It's only an
minutes.
Hour, 40 minutes or so. I mean, it's just, all right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.